Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Benyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. We got an excerpt from an email that I would like Lolita Hanks to read for us. Lolita, welcome to Bob Benyart Live.
Thanks, Bob.
Lolita, you're with Colorado Right to Life. You're a nurse practitioner, spokesperson there. And you got an email from a Mr. Ron Panzer, who's with the Hospice Patients Alliance. Could you read that excerpt that you pointed out to me?
Sure. I am thankful that someone from Right to Life in any state is paying attention. That is a sore point with me as I tried years ago to get anyone's attention and was ignored. National Right to Life Committee told me they weren't interested in the hospice killings and were focused only on legislative change. I know that that is not how the killings are going to be implemented nationwide. It is being backdoored through hospice, palliative care nationwide and or rammed through somehow.
Mm.
10 years ago, I was warning about hospice being usurped by the Right to Death crowd and being made into the killing fields.
You know what? I think Ron Panzer 10 years ago was ahead of his time because it seems like that's exactly what's been happening. And we are honored to have on the line right now Ron Panzer. Ron, welcome to Bob Benyart Live.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Ron, could you go ahead and talk to us about your work, your insight? We've been on the air, Bob Benyart Live has, for 20 years, 5 days a week, and the right to life of the unborn child has been a significant issue of ours, but also, of course, at the other end of life, when people are very possibly dying, it seems like we have a tragedy in America that is mostly ignored, even by conservative, Christian, pro-lifers, and as you pointed out, even by National Right to Life. So what's happening in our country?
People need to understand that hospice was originally founded by Dame Cicely Saunders in London, England, over 30, almost 40 years ago. And her vision was pro-life and certainly was Christian, and it's the type of hospice that most people have come to think of, where you have caring nurses and doctors and other professionals providing services to the dying, relieving their suffering as best they can with the modern medical science. And there have been many advances over time. The problem arises because there are people in the hospice industry who are not Christian, that are not any religion. Basically, many of them are atheist or agnostic and pro-euthanasia, right to die. Florence Wald, who was the dean of nursing at Yale University, heard Dame Cicely Saunders at a lecture many years ago, and she was the one that started the first hospice in America, the Connecticut Hospice.
When was that about?
1978 or so, in that time period. The late 60s was a lecture, and in the 70s was when the hospices were created, the early hospices that were formal in England and in the United States. There were volunteer hospices earlier. And what happened was Florence Wald was pro-assisted suicide, and there was a famous quote in a medical journal article that Florence Wald said that she was in favor of assisted suicide being provided for physical, emotional, psychological, and
economic,
as well as social and economic reasons.
Mm.
And this is very scary that as far back as decades ago, she was pro-assisted suicide, and the flavor of hospice that we have in the United States has been marketed to the public as pro-life, as most people understand hospice, but what actually is being delivered is a mix. So you have a very confusing situation for the public, because sometimes they'll find very dedicated nurses and doctors who provide wonderful care in hospice and are not hastening death, and then they hear someone saying that some people are being killed in hospice, and they're outraged.
Let me ask you, Ron Panzer, and Lolita Hanks here in studio with Colorado Right to Life. I am a talk show host for 20 years and the pastor of Denver Bible Church, so I have about as much experience with hospice as the average person, except that as a pastor, I do perform funerals for people. I visit folks in hospice. And it seems to me that the time that people, if we want to use the phrase linger, when people around them think they're going to die soon, it seems that the time that people linger has been shortened. And it even seems that when family are flying in to see their dying loved ones, it just seems to be uncanny how often that relative complies and dies on cue when the most family members are there.
Hospice professionals would have different responses to that comment. First of all, there are active signs of dying. The patient may have cold hands or knees and feet. They may turn blue or purplish. The blood pressure drops precipitously compared to their normal blood pressure. The respiratory rate or rhythm may change. There are certain clinical things that nurses and doctors look for, and you can say that a person is imminently dying when you see these what are called active signs of dying. So to have the family called is not unusual. I'm not going to come out and be the guy who's totally against hospice or totally for, and that confuses people because the reality is a mixture, and that's why people are confused. So you do have situations where it's appropriate to call them, and everybody comes and the patient dies because they really do clinically have the signs of dying, and they are dying.
Sure.
But on the other hand, what happens is you have a nurse say, the patient's dying tonight, call all the family members, or tomorrow, they're definitely dying, and you don't have these active signs of dying, and they still die, then that's very suspicious. You've got red flags. And usually in those cases, you have overdoses of morphine, sedatives that have been given for a week or more before that time, so the patient's fluid in the circulatory system is lessened, and they dehydrate, and their blood pressure collapses, so they die.
And Ron, you wrote an article, an excellent article. It was a beautiful death. It was a terrible death that I read a couple weeks ago. And I think you're trying to make clear during this interview that both sides of this issue is common in America's hospice industry and in our family experiences.
Well, depending on your worldview, you look at death differently. The hospice and palliative care movement has very much focused on the term quality of life. And if you understand the history of hospice in this country, you know that the Euthanasia Society of America changed its name and its form corporately a few times over the years to Choice in Dying, Society for the Right to Die, which was absorbed by Partnership for Caring, some of these hospice lobbying groups, Last Acts. But what is very striking, and the public has no idea, the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization absorbed all legal rights and copyrights to Last Acts Partnership, which is the successor organization over several generations of the Euthanasia Society.
And when you, Ron, and Lolita Hanks, please, Lolita, feel free to add to this conversation. When you mentioned their focus has been quality of life, I remember from studying about World War II that in Germany in the 1890s, a book was published that became very popular in the medical and scientific communities about quality of life, and that led into Germany's aggressive euthanasia program where they euthanized tens of thousands of Germans before they began killing Jews systematically. There's some classic books on that topic, extremely well documented.
Right. The book, The Nazi Doctors, specifically talks about that.
The Nazi Doctors, Cleansing of the Fatherland, A Sign for Cain, and the excerpted chapters, The German Euthanasia Program, all extremely well documented, that became a social tool to kill people who don't have a good enough quality of life. And then all of a sudden, you've got doctors deciding who has a good quality of life, and they ended up euthanizing German children, for example, who were bedwetting longer than the average child.
Right. It's very subjective. And the real issue is whether we as a society and really we as individuals have or hold dear the sanctity of life or quality of life. So the euthanasia people, right to die corner of this debate, have sold these ideas to the public for over 70, 80 years. They've been working, they've researched how to manipulate the public opinion on the issues. And they use words like quality of life, compassion, death with dignity. But death with dignity means something very different to someone who respects the sanctity of life than someone who cares less, and they feel you are better off dead if you're suffering from certain disabilities or illnesses. They justify in their minds killing the patient, feeling they're relieving suffering by ending the patient's life, whether voluntarily or involuntarily.
I would say as a nurse that I've observed a lot of times that the patient's family, that the suffering is bothering them way more than the patient at times. It's just like when you see the guy on the street corner, his suffering is bothering you maybe more than it does him, and so you don't want to see it. And so by having the family member's death hastened, they don't have to keep seeing it because it's bothering them.
Well, that's exactly right. The idea of disability, for example, scares people, and many people believe, I would not want to live if I had a disability. But what most people say, and I work with the disabled all the time in my work, they want to live, even though maybe beforehand they did not. The will to live is something that sticks with you, whether you have a terminal illness or whether you are disabled.
And even if you're in corrections, which I work in the prison, the people on that should be put to death or there for life, they don't want to die. You would think that somebody'd be miserable in prison, but they don't want to die. They'll hold on. So I agree with you about the will to live.
So, Ron, back when Terri Schiavo was basically being legislatively starved to death, killed, I remember a radio program on a competing station/network, Salem Radio Network, and it was very unusual program. There were three nationwide talk show hosts that all got together in the same studio at the same time, Michael Medved, Hugh Hewitt, and Dennis Prager. They said that the issue with Terri Schiavo, I thought this was tragic because they basically conceded the pro-life argument and joined the euthanasia crowd. They said the issue with Terri Schiavo is that she had not left a written directive. And if she had left a written directive, then for her to be starved to death would have been acceptable. And then they began to discuss what would qualify someone for the right to starve themselves to death. And they indicated that if you were a quadriplegic, you should have the right to deny food and water and basically kill yourself in that method. I felt that that was a sign, a symptom of how morally shallow the conservative movement in America has become, that our supposed conservative and or pro-life spokesmen don't understand that you don't kill someone because they are handicapped or because they're ill.
You're right. The whole idea of food and liquid sustenance being provided has been corrupted or perverted intentionally. There are certain people, I can call them people, stakeholders, behind the scenes in the country who have planned how to change our society. And I know this from professors and others who know the bioethicists personally from decades ago, and what they're doing now, but they have very specifically targeted certain states for legalization of different laws. And in Florida years ago, they changed the definition of food and water to something other than ordinary care, but they considered it medical treatment. And the moment you classify food and liquids as medical treatment,
right,
then it can be refused or prohibited by a doctor's order rather than the patient's wish.
And Ron Panzer with the Hospice Patients Alliance, we have this in Colorado where our law prohibits euthanasia, but our law also states, and so do our medical guidelines, that food and water are medical treatment,
right,
and so individuals, family members, can deny food and water, which is basically a way to euthanize someone, including a 4-year-old boy here at Denver Children's Hospital. I don't know if you've heard of this case. Lolita Hanks, you remember the case of Dylan Wolborn just a few years ago?
Yeah, he was a four-year-old boy that had severe disabilities, and his parents basically were convinced that he'd be better off dead.
Yeah, and so Denver Children's Hospital, their ethics board, considered the case of Dylan Wolborn, and they said, look, we think it's appropriate if you'd like to deny him food and water. And they actually threw, this was all documented in detail in the pages of the Denver Post, maybe a five-page in-depth article. They threw Dylan a going-away party. They had a Denver social worker. They had family members fly in. They had the assistant pastor of a local evangelical church invited, and that was when they stopped feeding him. It took Dylan a few weeks before he finally died. But here was a handicapped child who enjoyed having his mom read to him. He couldn't speak. He was severely disabled, but they'd put on his favorite movie that would soothe him. He enjoyed mom reading to him, and they decided this suffering is too much, and they euthanized him.
Right. Well, you know, there are several of these cases that have been publicized widely in the news media, but that's not, you know, and I don't want to downplay them, but what I want the public to realize is that that is less than the tip of the iceberg. There are hundreds of thousands of cases every year in this country where food and liquids are withdrawn and patients are hastened to their death, whether they are disabled, like Terry Schiavo, or terminally ill. And if you go back to the time of Terry Schiavo and look at the news articles that were published by the Associated Press, in many, many of those articles, they would quote a doctor who would say, I don't understand why there's being such a fuss made. We do this all the time. And most people would not notice that, but I did. Mm. And what it told me was that all over the country, they're doing the same thing, and it was being done all the time. In Terry's case, she was basically neglected and abused for many years. The actual truth of her case was never told to the public. Mm.
Well, we did hear Ron on this radio show. We covered Terry's case as it was unfolding. As the pastor of Denver Bible Church, a number of our church members went down to Florida to be there. Was it at Pinellas Park, nursing home where she was at? In fact, two of our church members were arrested for trying to, no violence, of course, but literally trying to bring a glass of water to Terry so she would not be dehydrated. And
the one thing that people need to realize is the purpose of life. We're getting into questions about what is the purpose of life, why are we here, and if you believe that all there is the physical reality, that there's no such thing as love, there's no such thing as God or spiritual fulfillment, then you think one way. I had a patient for many years who had spina bifida and would very much enjoy his family's company, but he was severely brain injured. And a lot of people of the Right to Die crowd would have said he would have been better off dead. But he certainly enjoyed his family. He would laugh. He enjoyed the interaction. But there's another side to this, which is what happens to our society when we interact with the disabled, the terminally ill, when we serve those who are disabled and ill, it's elevating and life-changing for the people who serve. And so there is a purpose in someone's life, even if they are disabled severely, because they are giving the gift of service to other people, which may sound strange to people, but if you've worked in nursing and healthcare, you understand what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Even in hospice, there is a gift to those who work with the dying that the dying provide. And there are many lessons that are taken by the family, the staff, and others who interact with them, and it's uplifting.
I agree with you, Ron, because when we start just killing people, we lose our humanity. You and I had talked in email about you're looking for pro-life hospices. Maybe you could give the folks some criteria that you're looking for, and since we only have about 9 more minutes left, maybe you also could just give the folks listening out there some pointers about how to deal with hospice personnel.
Yeah, what makes a pro-life hospice?
Well, a pro-life hospice. The hospice that most people expect is the pro-life hospice. It used to be all hospices would say, we never hasten death. But obviously they don't try to cure the incurable.
Right.
They care for the dying. People need to understand that if there are any red flags going off inside them, their intuition, their instincts are telling them that something is wrong, then it probably is wrong, and they need to either call us or talk with a nurse or doctor that they know personally, or perhaps transfer the patient to another hospice or even home health care rather than hospice. In some cases, that's the only place to go. The red flags are when medications are given that are not needed. And the biggies are when pain medications like morphine and others are given when the patient really doesn't have pain or the pain is already controlled, and they start increasing the dose.
The other thing, too, I would say is, like, I've seen people with Alzheimer's who are kind of agitated. You're supposed to titrate pain medicines accordingly. So maybe you give this person a Tylenol first, and then that seems to help. Well, then you give them Tylenol. You don't bring out the big guns. If they're bringing out the big guns first when someone hasn't, you know, had pain medicines for a long period of time, or it's not some acute trauma, then you have to wonder what they're doing.
Mm. Well, you know what they're doing. In a case when the pain is controlled and there is not really an issue with pain, if they're increasing in any way and it's not making any sense, it is a decision to kill or end the life of the patient. You need to know that. There's no question about it.
Ron Panzer, I had a friend who was in hospice just about 6 weeks ago. She's one of the sharpest people I ever knew. She's eloquent. She understands the medical community. She's done consulting, in fact, for doctors. And she said to me, I feel at risk at this hospice. I'm afraid of this hospice.
Right. And this is why we're creating an organization of pro-life hospices. Anyone who knows of a hospice that is dedicated to the sanctity of life and caring for the dying while honoring that sanctity of life needs to contact us. The signs of a pro-life hospice certainly are that medications are given when they're clinically indicated, when they need it. If they're agitated and they need an anti-anxiety medication, that's okay. But if you induce a coma in someone who's not agitated by over-sedating them, then this is the most common way of ending life in the United States intentionally, is terminal sedation when there is no agitation. And this is being used. This is the third way. Rather than assisted suicide and euthanasia, these are very small percentage-wise ways of killing patients in the United States. Most of the deaths are occurring through withdrawal of food and water while sedating the patient, mostly in hospices, but sometimes in hospitals and nursing homes as well. So we get calls all the time from family members, even patients, about what is being prescribed to the patient and the services being provided. If your instincts are telling you something's wrong, then you need to trust your instincts.
Follow your instincts, look into it, and then your website is hospicepatients.org.
That's correct.
So that's a great place to go for information, hospicepatients.org. Ron Panzer, have you heard of the case in, I believe it was Oregon, where a customer of an insurance company put in a claim for treatment and was denied treatment, but the options available to her in a letter back, she was told she could take a pill, a doctor-assisted suicide. They'd pay to euthanize her, but not for her requested treatment.
Yes, well, with the rationing of health care in the United States, that's something that people, especially the elderly, may look forward to, because the elderly are going to have care rationed for them. So treatment that is now available will not be available, and then they will be offered hospice when their conditions destabilize.
I would assert that the baby boomers that have pushed the death culture for the last 30 to 40 years are going to be victims of their own policies.
Well, that's exactly right. The people who are promoting right to die do not understand the realities of healthcare and how much of a business it actually is. So the decisions of whether you have the right to die are not necessarily going to be made by you, even if it's legalized.
Increasingly, these decisions and practices are in the hands of corporate America, multi-million-dollar firms that are looking at the bottom line.
Or the government.
The death panels and the government, as we've talked about. Ron, we really are almost out of time. Last point, when Terry Schiavo was dying, National Right to Life was pursuing something called the Incapacitated Persons Legal Protection Act. And we brought this up with Terry Schiavo's brother, Bobby Schindler, and he agreed with us that this was misguided legislation. They were doing the Hemlock Society a favor. They were giving federal recognition of state-assisted suicide laws. If there was a written directive to deny food and water, they were saying then you could starve the person to death. Otherwise, no. Hey, Ron, we are out of time. We want to have you back, all right?
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Ron Panzer, Lolita, thank you.